comments. I'm Charlotte Henry, and this is the last House of Comments of 2022. We've made it to the end.
Didn't think we would at times.
No, quite so. To help me celebrate this astounding feat is Emma Bunnell. How are you?
I am knackered, if I'm honest.
Right. We'll hear about that later on in the show.
Indeed.
So we thought, because finally we've almost had a quiet week of politics. Well, there's been the ongoing strikes, but we dissected them last week. And if you didn't hear our conversation about that, you can check back last week's show. We're not going to repeat what we said last week. Instead, we're going to look back at the year that was and just pick some of the key moments and events. And as you may have gathered from Emma's response, and she's quite right, there have been rather a few of them. The one I wanted to start with, and this may seem slightly strange, we've all kind of pushed it back to the back of our memories, was the end of all legal COVID restrictions. And when we were discussing this, Em, you quite rightly pointed out that this was a phase thing, and of course you're right. But there was one key moment for me, which was on February the 24th, and that was when all the legal restrictions expired. There was still some free testing going on and bits and bobs. It wasn't quote unquote the end, and we can debate if that will ever happen. But that was a sort of moment in time that, you know, things had changed quite dramatically. I don't know what you thought of that on that, you know, that day.
I mean, I don't remember it feeling like things have changed dramatically. I know, so theatres were kind of already back to normal.
Yeah, a lot of things were.
So all the things that mattered to me ongoing were kind of already there. Mm. The things that I'd really missed. So I don't. I think the reason I pushed back slightly on this one was not that the end of COVID restrictions isn't important, but that it just didn't feel like a moment as such. Whereas the other things we're going to discuss, you know, there was kind of a moment where you could see everything change, yeah. And this didn't feel like that.
No, lockdown
was a moment. Mm-hmm. Coming out of COVID has been a long, slow process.
Mm-hmm. You're absolutely right. I can't disagree with anything that you've said. It just felt to me that that was the kind of marker of, you know, a phase in fighting this virus in the UK. That's what I felt to me. But
no, and that's perfectly fair. And I think it's reasonable to mention it. Absolutely.
Yeah, but there was actually something far more dramatic and horrendous that happened that same day.
And
it defined the whole year. And that was on February the 24th, Russian troops invaded Ukraine. That was when that invasion started. We're, I think, recording this, we're 301 or 302 days into the invasion. Now, we have seen the most, and are gathering evidence of the most horrific actions by the Russian army. We have seen the most horrific loss of life. And to wake up one morning in 2022 and see a war on European soil. I mean, I'm not normally stumped for words on this show, neither are you. And I don't know if you can, but I can't find the words.
I mean, it was so shocking, and we'd seen the build-up, so we kind of knew it was coming, and yet we just couldn't convince ourselves that it was coming, and it wasn't just Putin, right. You know, posturing. And I think, if I'm honest, once it did happen, I thought it'd be over fairly quickly. And that's the other story.
Yes,
there's a story of aggression, but there's an incredible story of the resistance of the Ukrainians and the strength of their belief in their own right to self-autonomy, to democracy.
To defend
their homeland, but also they have quite clearly, when you look at the kind of street scenes from Kyiv and things like that, they now look like a European city. And in the ways that also some places in Poland really do as well. I've spent some time in Poland. And there is, they are clearly facing Europe and embracing that part of their identity more than their traditional Russian part. And I think that in many ways is what's caused the aggression. But that is what they're fighting for, their right to make that choice.
Yes, and obviously another part of from what we understand, I don't profess to be an expert in Russian affairs or the mind of Vladimir Putin, but as I don't think anyone could be an expert in that, but I'm not convinced he is. But one of the things that clearly triggered him wanting to conduct this invasion was a sort of old belief in, you know, Mother Russia, of returning to this grand Soviet state.
I think it's pre-Soviet. I think a lot of it's down to the kind of Tsarian stuff.
This idea that, you know, that whole region is Russia.
Any kind of Soviet ideology other than the accumulation of land and power.
Yeah, and this idea that all those countries around Russia are really Russia.
Yeah.
Not the independent nations they have been since the breakup of the Soviet Union, and that they have shown themselves to be for many years. And of course, one of the great irony seems too light a word, but it is almost that, is what Putin, by invading Ukraine, has done is also turned other countries to facing Europe and facing NATO. We've seen, say, the Finnish response.
Yeah. And, you know, Finland were resistance to joining NATO for many, many years. And now they've, you know, it felt like, I guess, in Finland had to pick a side, and they did so without any qualms. Yeah, it wasn't a choice. Even.
No, you're quite right. And I want to talk about the British response and indeed the American response, because we're recording this the week Zelensky has finally felt confident to leave Ukraine and traveled to the USA, which is quite an amazing moment in of itself. But I want to go back to what you said right at the beginning, which was, you, as you watched it, you couldn't quite believe it was actually going to happen, because we'd heard rumblings for what, 2-3 weeks, almost since the beginning of the year.
And, you know, the thing with Putin is he sort of regularly went on these military exercises. Yes. And of course, this is not the first time he's invaded Ukraine.
No, this has been going on since 2014 in Crimea.
Yeah, the Crimea stuff has been, and then was shamefully very accepted and kind of, oh, all right then.
I think that's a really good point. You know, we saw a World Cup in Russia four years after he'd taken Crimea.
Exactly. So I think we were just, I mean, I don't know whether I have no real contacts in our defence establishment, so I don't know if they were as gobsmacked as the rest of us, but it just felt a sense. I think because there'd been so many times that Putin had danced up to a line and not crossed it.
Yes.
That I think we were maybe complacent about that.
Yeah, and it obviously showed a shift in his mindset and what he thought was possible and would be acceptable in the world. And the world, essentially, with, you know, there has been some notable exceptions, but, you know, for example, even India very quickly was like, this is enough.
Yeah,
and changed its stance from... But the British response, I have to say, there is many things we have and will continue to criticise Boris Johnson on for this show. But his response to this was unequivocal. It was quick, and it was the right response to immediately back Ukraine. Now, we can, you know, maybe talk about his weird Churchillian cosplaying. We can talk about the coincidence that every time he seemed to be in domestic political trouble, he suddenly turned up in Kyiv. And I think those are all fair points. But he put himself very quickly and very distinctly on the right side of this, and put the country on the right side of this. And I think, for whatever else we want to criticise him for, we should remember and praise that.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. I mean, I think...
Blimey, I'm going to clip that.
I mean, yeah, no, and I've said this repeatedly on the television as well. I don't rate Boris Johnson for much, but even a stop clock and all that.
Yeah.
But also, I mean, I think if you were going to invent a crisis that was absolutely perfect for everything Boris Johnson wants to be in his head, then you would have a very obvious moral choice war that you don't actually have to send boots in the ground on.
Yes.
So, you know, the downside's not that high for him. I felt that the British response was very good. I'm glad that we have been arming the Ukrainians. And I'm glad that we have taken in refugees and have been. I mean, one of the things that does slightly mar it is that there is a, because the British state is completely knackered after 12 years of cuts, some of the schemes that are there to support those refugees haven't worked as well as they should. But I'm glad that we have at least agreed in principle that that is the country we want to be.
And I also think because of the strength of Boris Johnson's initial response, and also, you know, the work the Defence Secretary Ben Wallace has done with far less fanfare than Boris Johnson ever made. And I think probably, again, we're going to come on to her, obviously, but and it won't be praiseworthy, but, you know, Liz Truss as Foreign Secretary as well. They, you know, they coalesced very quickly, did the right things very quickly, and made it basically impossible for any successors in their roles to get wobbly and turn their back on Ukrainians. And I'm really pleased on that. We do also have to talk about the domestic effects of this, because whatever the back and forth we've had on spending and inflation and everything else, it is quite clear that Putin's invasion of Ukraine, it's not just a Tory talking point, like Putin's invasion of Ukraine has dramatically had effects on our energy costs, on inflation, on many things that you and I deal with every day. And, you know, Brits, we can argue whether why Britain was not in a good place to weather some of those storms. And I think those are serious debates to be had. But it's very clear that I wanted to say flashpoint, that's not really appropriate, but the tipping point perhaps was this war with all the fallout it had for energy supplies and other things. And it's very clear Putin has used energy as a weapon to try and break Ukraine's allies.
He has. And I think that there is a at the moment, a staunch sense that we won't be broken in that mm-hmm. way. I think that will hold through one winter. I think it gets harder if we're into a 2-year, 3-year war.
Yeah, I think. I think you're absolutely right that the longer it goes on and it's not Britain being attacked, that inevitably becomes harder to sell to a British domestic crowd and electorate. You're obviously correct about that, but I hope that our solidarity with the Ukrainian people continues.
I agree. Absolutely. Slava Ukraini.
Exactly. And well, we've mentioned the kind of end of Boris Johnson. Let's turn back domestically.
Yeah.
Because you may have noticed we've had a few prime ministers this year. And we moved on from COVID legal restrictions. But one thing we can't move on that's COVID related is so-called Partygate.
Yeah.
The emerging stories of that there were parties and social gatherings of all kinds in Number 10, whilst various levels of restrictions were placed on the British public. Now, I have zero interest in debating whether those lockdowns and restrictions were correct or not, because they've gone now. Frankly, that's for the inquiry to deal with.
Yeah.
And I'm sure we will have an episode on that when it comes out. But what I do want to talk about is what this... frankly, I was furious when I found out, but there's few political stories that have made me as angry as reading about Partygate. I don't know how you feel. I sort of got a sense that you felt not dissimilar to me.
Yeah, absolutely. Of course I did. I mean, I think it's not just that they... I had a fucking awful lockdown. You can bleep that if you want to. I don't know how grown up a podcast we are.
Emma, please, darling, it's us. We're not very grown up.
And I had a serious post-COVID mental health crisis a few months before Partygate started to break.
You're very brave, and I appreciate you being so honest. And I think the point is so many people of various ways felt the same as you. You know, how could we not have felt horrendous?
Because I stuck to the rules and I found it really, really hard. But I did it because I thought it was the right thing to do. finding out that they had laughed in my face, basically. And
that is what it felt like, wasn't it? That they were sipping champagne and having canapes and sort of taking the piss.
They were taking the piss. They were taking the piss out of the little people who didn't matter, like me. And my blood was absolutely boiling. And then, instead of going, we massively messed that up, we are so sorry, we take full responsibility, they lied and they lied and they lied, and it got dripped out that every time they lied, it got overturned. We then saw the video of Allegra Stratton. I mean, it's slightly ironic that Allegra Stratton was the only one who lost her job, given that she wasn't actually at the parties.
Yeah, I'm pleased you mentioned that, because I felt... Look, I don't know if I felt sorry for Allegra Stratton, but there was a point where Boris Johnson was clinging on, and his kind of closest acolytes were defending him, and everyone was... There was a bit of gaslighting, I felt, from some... on the right, being like...
I don't feel sorry for Allegra Stratton, not least after some of her shenanigans at Newsnight. But
I'll tell you why I felt...
I feel it's ironic that she's the only one to go.
Yeah, Well, Boris Johnson ultimately...
Well, yes, she, at that point, it was...
Correct. Like, and it went on for a long time that she was the only one to have gone.
Yeah.
And look, there was... And she was the only one that seemed genuinely to understand what the problem was, and to be genuinely sorrowful. I think that's why I say I feel sorry for her. And there
I'm a sucker. When Theresa May welled up when she left Downing Street, it touched my heart. When Allegra Stratton was you know, bawling her eyes out on her own steps. Yeah, I'm a human being. Of sure. course that touched me. But on the other hand, yeah, of course she should have lost her job.
I don't disagree that she should have lost her job, but I found an irony that in this kind of boys' club around Boris Johnson, it was the woman that lost their job.
Yeah.
But ultimately, this did bring Boris Johnson down, and quite rightly so, eventually. I think, basically, your point about lying...
I don't think it was Partygate. In the end, what brought Boris Johnson down, it was ministerial self-interest. They kept being sent on the Today programme to defend Chris Pincher, and the line would change while they were on the radio, so they looked like idiots.
That was the straw that broke the camel's back. You're absolutely right. But I think what happened during Partygate, as you said, they lied and they lied and they lied. And Tory, you know, there were, again, Tory MPs that were sent out to defend what had gone on, and it was frankly indefensible.
Yeah.
So I think that it was the build-up of Partygate did directly lead to the end of Boris Johnson. It might not have been what finally pushed the Tory MPs to the end, but it definitely, definitely was the build-up of that. I think they eventually got sick of being lied to, watching the British public lied to, and having to lie.
Yeah,
I do think that, and that is directly connected to Partygate, I would say.
Yeah, I mean, I think someone on Lewis Goodall on the News Agents, so it was either Lewis or John Sokol, said, you know, you would have government spokespersons who would obfuscate, but if you asked them, did this happen in a direct way, they'd have to answer you. And that just didn't happen here. They just lied. And I think partly journalists have a platform and they really hate being lied to. It's like, part of their ethical stance. So I think that's what really happened. Once they knew they were being lied to, the bit was between their teeth.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And I think we should take them. I've criticised the lobby plenty of times and the way the system of parliamentary reporting in Westminster works. But the way Paul Brand of ITV and Pippa Quera, now of The Guardian, but then of The Mirror, went after this is the best of political journalism. And they deserve huge amounts of praise for it.
Absolutely. It very, very good, straightforward, investigative political journalism.
Yeah.
Top of the line.
So that was the end of Boris Johnson. And we'll come on to the shenanigans post-Boris Johnson. But again, I think we should take a pause here, talk about something. We talked about some negative things. I want to talk about something positive. And that is the work of Crisis at Christmas. We mentioned it last week and I want to mention it again. There is still time. I made my donation last week. There is still time to head over to crisis.org.uk and help someone have a Christmas meal, a bed over Christmas, be washed, fed, looked after for a few days over Christmas. It is the most wonderful cause. In fact, it's so wonderful. Emma gives up her time to do some shifts and work with the guests at Crisis at Christmas. You've done a couple, haven't you, already?
I've done two already. I was there last night. Oh, we had a shift last night. Oh, we had a shift. It was a busy one.
Was the walkie-talkie in action, Emma?
The walkie-talkie was very much in action. So I run the shift office and I was on my own. You usually get one or two people running the shift office, and I was on my own for the first time. Although people are always in and out, obviously. But so it's like the back office, and I run everything. I had to call ambulances, other centres, try and find where things are, which are always lost. I can tell you I don't go into too much detail about what does and doesn't happen because it's not fair on our guests. But I can tell you that the one thing that has been true every year I've been at Crisis is that we never have enough bin bags. Every year the cry goes up, bring bin bags. So I don't know why that is, but I'm definitely that's my one piece of feedback is we need more bin bags. But it is wonderful, and you know, I don't get out sadly into the reception area as much as I'd like to talk to the guests, because I've obviously got to keep things going behind the scenes. But when you do get out and you see people sitting and chatting and talking to family on the phone, and watching that, we get great entertainment in, and just being in the warm sociably, you know, eating, you know, they provide very nice meals with beef stroganoff last night. It's really good. And it just all is so wholesome, I suppose. Yeah. Is that twee?
No, I don't think it is. Well, I'm here. I mean, I might be going twee now, but I kind of, when you're describing what happens and how the guests are treated as guests, not people dragged off the street, to me, it just sort of, the word that comes to my mind is dignity. And I think that's so important.
No, absolutely. The key, so we always have this really long briefing before our shift, where they go through things that have happened, things that might happen. And it has to be quite long because every day there's somebody who's new on shift who hasn't done it before. But if you've done it a few times, you're like, oh, I really want to go and get on with it now. But the one they say, like, there's been a lot of information, but the key thing is to smile. And that always hits me because that's that human moment. And we're so bad at it. So I do always, if someone's, you know, I don't tend to give cash on the street because I'm aware that it's not always the best way of helping. Occasionally if I'm feeling flush, I'll go and buy someone a sandwich, but what I do is smile and say I'm sorry rather than just not catch their eye.
Yeah,
because there's that moment of giving someone recognition as a human.
Yeah. And you laughed last week that by the time people have to leave the Crisis at Christmas centres, the guests look considerably better than you lot who have been working with them. As I pointed out last week, so you can donate whatever you're comfortable donating, but you told me the £29.07, which is the default donation, and it's very easy to, you press one button, it rounds up automatically to 30 quid, plus there's gift aid, I think, as well, which helps as well. That covers one person, doesn't it, for the whole stay?
That covers one guest for their stay, yeah.
So, yeah, please head over.
And then all of the people who are in those centres, you might get one or two crisis staff, but most of us are volunteers. And there are volunteers like me, we're just general volunteers. But there are also, we have Samaritans, we've got people with legal advice, housing advice, immigration, benefits advice. And then we have people who come in who are hairdressers, manicurists. So it's such a lovely wide range of services that are on offer.
Yeah, it's about more than just getting someone off the street for a few days. It, as we say, it sort of restores dignity and gives people some hope, and actually makes Christmas a bit of an event as well. So yes, please do head over to crisis.org.uk and help in whatever way you feel comfortable. And thank you so much, because it's a cause that Emma and I both feel very passionate about. Okay, that was lovely. I'm sorry, we have to return.
Oh no!
I'm sorry. We've got here. We've done very well. We got, you know, we've been deeply moved by the resilience of the Ukrainians. Yeah, I'm sorry. We've been moved by the resilience of the Ukrainians. We've been cross at Boris Johnson. And now we have to get to Liz Truss. Emma, what the hell was that?
Well, that was every Tory ideology exploding at once. Taxpayers Alliance, the 55 Tufton Street, your boys took one hell of a beating.
Well, let's not get into the weird conspiracies around some think tanks, but what definitely did happen was that...
No, this is not a weird conspiracy. I work in think tanks. They exist to feed ideas to politicians.
Sure.
Liz Truss was a politician who had published with these think tanks, worked very closely with these think tanks. It's not a conspiracy to say that these think tanks were the defining pillars of the ideology that she brought to government.
Sure, but I also suspect they're pretty cross at what happened, because they may have agreed with the idea. Well,
oh no, look, it turns out all our bullshit doesn't actually, the second it's a hit reality, it implodes.
So let me put it this way. There are individual ideas, and actually I don't want to say quite light, because I wouldn't put it that way. I thought the idea of trying to shift from what we had as the norm. You know, we've talked about the managed decline that's been going on, and obviously Liz Truss was not buying into that. You know, I'm pretty comfortable with ideas like reducing the basic rate of tax, for example, as one example of what she tried to do. What she got just so spectacularly wrong, and I think I've seen Kwasi Kwarteng talk about this as well, was the methods of executing these policies was just abysmal. You can like the policies or not like the policies, but
the policies are bullshit, caused the market to panic. They didn't like them.
They didn't like the execution.
They didn't like the policies.
I think the execution... Well, they probably didn't like some of the policies. You're absolutely right. But
you cannot borrow a fuck ton of money to lower people's taxes. You could probably borrow a fuck ton of money.
Right, let's pause on that, because that's a really...
You could have borrowed a fuck ton of money to maybe build an asset that we can offset that against, like some infrastructure, but you can't do it to give it all away to your rich fucking mates.
Well, I don't think reducing the basic rate of tax is giving away money to rich people. But anyway, the point is...
You think the 45p tax rate is being paid for by my neighbours is bin man?
I was talking about the basic rate of tax.
Okay, well, the basic rate of tax wasn't what they were talking about. They were talking about the 45p rate of tax.
They also wanted to reduce the basic rate of tax from 20p to 19p.
The one thing that's still standing from that is stamp duty, something that is almost entirely out of the reach of almost most people under 45 these days.
I think what happened, as I say, first of all, most of the policies have gone, so trying to rehash them is not a particularly good use of time. But what, as I say, you can like the policies or
don't, because they were absolutely moronic.
What I think you can debate the policies till the cows come home, and that's almost an irrelevance now, because the level of execution, up to and including deciding that it was a good idea not to let the Office for Budget Responsibility look at them first, was just so obviously, to anyone with understanding of financial markets, the humans that work in financial markets, the way politics responds to such things, it was just obviously never going to fly. Whether you liked what she was trying to do or not, it was all, that was just not the way you conduct policy. And frankly, it is certainly not the way you conduct quite radical policy shifts, because you have to lay the ground for such things. And
absolutely. I mean, I think that's...
And they categorically failed to do that. And it...
I mean, they were very good at playing politics. They were really bad at playing government.
I was going to say, I wasn't convinced they're very good at playing politics. But yes, I see what you mean. They were good at sort of sounding off, but they weren't good at actually executing ideas. That is absolutely right. So 49 days later, well, Liz, Kwasi Kwarteng, her chancellor, was gone, 3 weeks?
Yeah, something like that.
I think really he made it 3 weeks. Liz Truss made it 49 days. And Rishi Sunak came in, a former chancellor.
But she did have the two monarchs. That's going to be a great pub quiz question one day.
It's going to be. It is a great... Yes, of course, in between all of that, I can't believe this wasn't on our list of major events of the year. I mean, whether you're a monarchist or not, it was a huge moment in British history. The irony of all ironies is that the shortest serving prime minister was there at the funeral and spoke at the funeral of the longest serving monarch. It's, as you say, it's going to be a great pub quiz question. My other pub quiz question for you was, how many chancellors have we had this year?
Let me see. Rishi Sunak, Nadeem Zahawi, Kwasi Kwarteng, Jeremy Hunt, 4.
I think it's 4 as well. But less than
five education secretaries.
Oh, at least. And I don't even want to know how many of the other offices. I think we've had basically the only one that stayed the whole way is Ben Wallace, the defence secretary.
Yeah.
Because he's sort of calm and sensible. No one wants to shift him in the middle of a European war.
And Suella Braverman on a revolving door.
Yes, we've had her a couple of times, at home secretary. But anyway, we did get Rishi Sunak, and he's made it longer. He's made it to the end of the year.
He's made it to the end of the year. Well, the year hasn't ended yet.
We've got a week. But it was quite a bizarre period in time. And I genuinely, again, whatever one thinks of the policies and the ideas that either of those two were trying to implement and have implemented, I think the damage that 6, 7, 8 week period did to people looking in on Britain, it looked farcical.
We
might have got to a sort of relatively stable place now. And, you know, I think Rishi Sunak is a very sensible, fairly sensible, intelligent guy. I don't particularly like the way him and Jeremy...
taken us back to managed decline.
Yeah, exactly. Sure that's what I...
But, you know, it's... If your choice is managed decline or instant decline, I suppose you go for the managed option.
Yeah, I think I said that on a couple of our first shows after we launched. I was a bit depressed by it all, that it was all a bit blur, and I still feel like that. But he is at least someone who, to the outside world, is credible and sensible. It was quite a moment in time to have a non-white prime minister, to have a prime minister of Indian descent. I think that is something we should celebrate. Interestingly, of all the chances.
But I think also what's really nice in some ways is how much that's passed without it being a huge
quite
deal.
Quite so. Like, did you see the infamous Trevor Noah clip? Pretending that we'd all had a meltdown because we didn't have a white prime minister, and everyone in Britain was just like, what?
What?
You what?
Yeah,
and people on the left were just like, what? bizarre.
There are parts of the British left and parts of the British right that try to impose American politics on the UK.
Yes, yes, yes.
Just doesn't fit.
Americans...
It's worse when the Americans try to do it.
Yes, absolutely. Americans trying to purport their... export their politics onto us, and it just sitting there being like, you what?
It's like those weird New York Times articles where it says that all you can get to eat in London is suet pudding. You're like, really? Where do you get suet pudding? And B, like, we are literally one of the best culinary destinations in the world.
Yeah, I can't really deal with New York Times on Britain. It's almost become a parody of itself. But anyway. Yeah. I think there. Look, there's been some major historical moments this year. We've named multiple of them. Oh, you know, some of them are quite depressing. A war in Europe. You know, whether you, as I say, whether you're a royalist or not, the death of Queen Elizabeth II was a huge moment in British history. And watching those funerals and what happened through those period of days was a huge moment in history for a longest serving monarch. We'll have King Charles's Christmas message. I have no doubt, Emma, you'll be breaking away.
The Queen's Christmas.
I don't
message.
Believe you. You'll be
I'm
breaking
never
away.
Watch it.
I look forward.
I haven't watched the second of the Harry and Meghan documentary.
No, I haven't watched that.
On the telly. Don't give a shit about any. I didn't watch the funeral. I didn't comment on it, like, because ultimately there were people who were upset, and it's like, there's no need to be digging at it. But no, it just holds no interest to me.
Harry and Meghan has held no interest to me. That is not what my Netflix subscription has gone towards. As we've just said, the first non-white British Prime Minister, the first British Prime Minister of Indian descent. It's been quite a year, hasn't it?
It has been a hell of a year. Also, there was, of course, a small matter of a sold-out play.
Triggered was my highlight of the year, of course. But I do want to ask you, look, we'll wrap up happily and nicely and send ourselves into Christmas and the new year on a positive. What has been your best moment of 2022, the thing you'll reflect most positively on? Obviously your play, but I'm talking more in terms of the national scale in politics. Or beyond, in culture, because I can assure you mine's not a politics one.
As a Labour supporter, I haven't felt that good about a Labour Party conference since I started going in 2002, because obviously 2003 was Iraq dominated. And the conference this year was so professional and so interesting and so buzzy and so positive and so united. It just felt like a different world. Well, it felt like the Tories, but without the awful politics. I was very cynical about whether Labour were a party on a route to power. And that conference really changed my mind. I was seriously impressed.
Well, we will no doubt be discussing all of that and that path, perhaps to power, in 2023. I'm going to end on something completely different to you. You've gone very high-minded. I'm going to talk about something that is absolutely typical of me. I bet you can guess what I'm going to say. And I can only end by talking about the Lionesses,
high-minded too.
It is, in a way, because they have clearly blazed a trail for women in football and sport as a whole. But that was just such a moment for me. I did laugh. There was a meme going around, which was some men going, "It's coming home, it's coming home." Years later, the women go, "Oh, sod it, I'll get it myself." which did make me giggle. But it was a wonderful moment. Millions, millions, millions. I think it was 50 million. Tuned in to watch the final on television. Apparently the tournament as a whole got 365 million globally on TV. It was a huge moment. It's been wrapped up by Beth Mead picking up Sports Personality of the Year, the team winning Team of the Year, and Serena Wiegmann winning Coach of the Year. It was just a wonderful, wonderful moment. And for me, the defining image, well, one of the defining images, the defining positive image of 2022 is Chloe Kelly running away with a shirt over her head, running around in a sports bra as England go on. And actually, there's also, I popped into the Nike store in the centre of London the day after the girls had won. And there was these wonderful T-shirts of, I think Nike put two, who obviously worked with the team, put two kind of slogans on around the store and on T-shirts and stuff. It said, "Just done it." And home with the Nike tick. And for me, that was just in a difficult and sometimes miserable year, that was a real moment of joy.
Yeah, absolutely. Well done.
Yeah, we won't talk about poor Harry Kane and the men. We'll move on from that. Emma, have a very Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year.
Happy Hanukkah, Charlotte.
Yes. We've got a few more days of Hanukkah left. We've got Christmas to come. We've got a new year.
Have you got a dreidel?
I haven't. I've had one donut. I've been restrained on the donut front. But we'll see. That might deteriorate quite rapidly as we come into the weekend. But yes, where can people keep up with you if they're worried about missing you for the couple of weeks we're off from this show?
So I'm at EmmaBurnell_ on Twitter, and you can read my newsletter, Hard Thinking on the Soft Left.
And I'm at Charlotte A. Henry on the Twitters. TheEdition.substack.com is my newsletter, and there's a podcast there as well, which is on slightly different topics to this one. I hope everyone has a happy Hanukkah, Christmas, one very happy and healthy new year, and we will see you then.